Good morning. Before I get started, I'd love to thank Star, where's she at, for inviting me out here and doing a great job this weekend. I want to give her a big round of applause. Very organized. I was going through some deals with my mom. She was having some health issues, so I was running behind on a lot of stuff. And thank you for your patience and working with me. You know, I was late getting my plane tickets, the whole nine yards, and she was so patient. And I just really appreciate that. Thanks to my host, Aaron. You know, it's been a pleasure. We did get to go out to lunch yesterday. Got to know each other. I'm hoping these guys come out to Oregon. So that being said, Lee, thank you so much for referring me up here. You know, I did a little... You do these Zoom meetings, and Zoom really served a purpose, but, you know, you don't get a lot of reaction. There's no crowd feedback, and, you know, I was on a Zoom meeting, and I was like, okay, you don't even know if people are really listening, and Lee recorded it and passed it on, and, you know, and here I am, and what a blessing, you know, what a blessing to be here this morning. I want to recognize somebody. Every conference you go to, there's kind of that guy that's kind of the mascot that comes up and he jumps in and he's brand new. And I'd like to recognize, you want to stand up there for a second, Hot Sauce? Stand up. This is the kid right here. We were running late. We were running late and came in the door, and I was looking for Star and Aaron, and they were busy, and he just grabbed us right away, showed us what to do, where to go, and we realized this kid had grown up like, we think he might be Amish, grew up under a rock. I guess he just tried hot sauce for the first time, like that's why they call him Hot Sauce, like 2 months ago. He had never had a Dorito. So we took him out to lunch yesterday, and we're talking about new experiences in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? So we got him to eat an oyster yesterday for the first time, and he actually liked it, he said. So that'll add to it. He's a big, Cheetos and macaroni and cheese fan. So that's where we're coming from. But I love you, buddy, and, you know, that stands. I hope you come out to the Roundup. We have a Roundup in Oregon, Seaside, in April, and I really do hope you make it out there, buddy. It's been a pleasure. So, I get to my sponsor. This is the kind of support I get from him. So it's a blessing to be out here. Bob is my sponsor's favorite speaker. So I told him, I'm like, hey, I'm really excited. I'm going to be out here speaking at a conference. I'm expecting some support, like a Yahoo. And he's like, this is literally what comes back to me. I'm texting him, and he said, you go to a lot of concerts, right? And I'm like, yeah. And he said, so let's say Bob is the Rolling Stones. And I'm like, yeah. And he said, you're like an opening band. I'm like, okay. And he says, they might like to hear your music, but they're there to see the Rolling Stones. So I'm like, gee, thanks, Ponce. Thanks for the support. So, who's my newcomers out there? Who has less than a year out here this morning? There we go. I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I hope this morning, I believe in the fifth tradition. The only thing I'm doing up here today is carry the message to the alcoholic that still suffers. Now, you might be new. You might be suffering in the rooms. I've been both. But I hope I deliver a story up here with depth and weight, and that keeps you coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous for at least one more day. That's my goal. That's my only thing. And there might be one person out there this morning that needs to hear what I have to say. And only you're going to know who you are. And the rest of you can have a cup of coffee when you leave here, and you know, and I hope you hear something that keeps you coming back as well. I'm going to start by, I always start by reading out of the big book, page 124, my favorite passage. It took me a while to realize that 124 was actually my sobriety date. I'm a little slow, so that took me about 2 years. But as Tim says, I might have stayed out there a week too long. So here it is. So this is the one that hit home.
And he says, showing others who suffer how we were given help is the very thing which makes life seem so worthwhile to us now. Cling to the thought that in God's hands, the dark past is the greatest possession you have, the key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death and misery for them. And I realized that's what it was in here. I was so ashamed of my past for so many years that, you know, I hid it from everybody. And what I heard from you guys in here is that rigorous honesty. And using that to help me, and that's the deal, is I needed those stories that impacted me and realized that my past was okay, and that my and what I've realized from that is my biggest curse has become my biggest blessing. And so with that, my name is Aaron. I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is January 24th, 2007, which does mean I just celebrated 15 years on Monday. I would also like to recognize Tyler. They were nice enough to fly him out here too. That's my second longest sponsee. We've been working together about 10 years. He just celebrated 11 years on January 23rd. So, and Liam and Tim, my two other bodyguards, you know, it's nice to travel in Alcoholics Anonymous and have friends. You know, that's what it's about. I have made lifelong friends in this program. So, my home group is the Canby Saturday Breakfast Meeting. We meet at 9 a.m. at Pappy's Greasy Spoon in Canby, Oregon. The food is as good as it sounds. And as Rachel was saying yesterday, what I do, and I've thrown this out here a lot, was if you make it out to Oregon and you make it to that meeting, I will buy you breakfast. And that's the honest to God truth, you know, because it is my home. And if you come to my home, I'm going to get you a meal. And lots of people have taken me up on that. And but I love that. I love people coming. I always say it's the best meeting this side of the Mississippi, but I'm on the other side now. I haven't been to a lot of meetings out here. I don't know about this side, but it is the best meeting that side of the Mississippi. I can tell you that. I spent thousands of dollars on breakfast. That's an exaggeration, Belinda. You know, hundreds and hundreds, probably. We both exaggerate. I might tell some tall tales. But I have a sponsor who knows he's my sponsor. I have worked the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. The only reason I'm up here today is through my mother's prayers and the 12 steps and believing in a power greater than myself. And that's the deal. I work with other alcoholics. That's what keeps me in the middle of this thing, and I do service work. And I'm plugged in. You know, I grabbed onto this thing because, like it says in the 12 and 12, you know, I was a dying man, and I was ready to do whatever it took to just quit drinking originally, you know. So I'm going to go back. Usually we're running this. I'm the last speaker. Usually I start when I'm an embryo. Alex, the Al-Anon, you know, he started when he was one, you know. So when he was first born, I like that. But I'll try to cut it somewhat short. I know people got to travel. I was telling Star last night. I said, usually I know when I got about 10 minutes left when you guys circle up for the Lord's Prayer. So I'll try to cut it a little short before that. So I grew up in a little town called Eddyville, Oregon. And if you don't know where that is on a map, nobody in Oregon does either. It's just a little bump in the road. It was a logging community. My dad was a reforestation contractor. This was back in the 70s. A lot of extracurricular activities going on. He ran crews of tree planters. And, you know, it was a rough crowd. And they did a lot of, you know, it was kind of an outlaw lifestyle. My dad and mom were both alcoholics. My dad would drink, you know, he used to say for years, 12 years straight, he said, I drank no less than a half case of beer a day. But I never watched my dad miss a day of work due to drinking. You know, that's just the way it was. They'd drink, you know, in the crew cab, going to work, you know, whatever it was. I don't ever remember my dad driving around without a beer when I was a kid. And that's how I grew up. It wasn't, they never told me, my mom or my dad, hey, you know, this is a secret deal. Don't go to school and talk about what we do. It's just what he did. And I grew into that. Now, That being said, well, also, I'd like to touch on my grandpa. I love my grandpa. He was head of sales for Olympia Brewing Company. And this was back in the day, back in the 70s, when Olympia was the big beer. And I had Olympia everything as a kid, right? And we had about 30 acres. We lived out in the middle of nowhere. I mean, I grew up, it was like the 1800s, the first house that we lived in when I was a kid. So we had Olympia, and this will give you a little bit of insight onto where I came from, right? We had an Olympia beer truck was our storage shed, the back end of an Olympia beer, and there was constantly some sort of poached deer. You know, my dad, you know, just had this thing for shooting deer. I grew up on venison, and there was always some sort of animal hanging in there. And so that just gives you a little clue of who your speaker is, right? And like I said, outlaw lifestyle, but hard workers. I come from a line of hard workers. And so I went to school in Eddyville. I graduated with 19 kids in my class, pretty much the same 19 that I started school with. It's like a family when you grow up like that. Like I said, it was a logging community. I didn't start drinking. I tried my first sip of alcohol because it was accessible when I was like 4 years old. I remember one of my dad's company parties. We used to have big pig bakes, and one of his friends gave me a sip of whiskey. And I remember it was horrible. I'm not going to say I started drinking at 4 years old, but that's kind of, you know, how accessible it was. I did start drinking, you know, we'd drink around Christmas and stuff. My dad would buy us whiskey and stuff for Christmas, you know, around 12. I remember my first drunk around 12. But I started drinking on a regular basis, probably about the age of 15. So right out of the gates, I drank alcoholically. And it was the missing link for me. You know, it gave me everything, you know, it gave me the superpowers, right? Like everybody said, you know, I could talk to girls. You guys know the deal. You know, it just opened up a whole new world for me. And I started drinking a lot. I started missing school. We had this thing called Saturday school where the kids that didn't show up to school, my coach would always say, he goes, "Aaron, you know why you sit in Saturday school so much?" He goes, "Because you miss so much Monday school." And that became a recurring theme in my life. You know, I missed a lot of Monday school, missed a lot of Monday work coming up. I went right into high-lead logging when I was 17 or 18 years old. And Tim says, you know, out here you see a lot of, you know, what we call kind of toothpicks on the logging side. We're talking 200-foot timber, and it was hard work, you know. And it's basically when you're out there, it's like man against nature. And those guys drank, and we could do that. You know, I was 18 years old, and we'd stop at the end of the day, and we'd stop at the store, and we'd all sit around the crew cab, and they'd just feed me beers. And there was no police officers where I grew up. You know, we were out in the middle of the hills. So I moved over. You know, I got my first apartment in the next town over. It was Philomath. There was about 4,000 people there, the big city for me, and they had police officers. And I'd walk down Main Street drinking a beer because that's how I grew up, right? And they'd roll up, and I'm like, I'm a logger, right? I'm doing man's work, and I can drink when I want. And they'd go, "That's awesome. Let me drive, you know, write you up a minor in possession. Here you go." I got a lot of those. I didn't learn my lessons very quick. I had a lot of fun. I think Rachel was saying I had a lot of fun drinking, and it took me to a lot of crazy places. But I drank right out of the gate. The big book talks about, you know, the problem drinker, like, hey, maybe you have a problem or problems with your wife or you get in trouble, maybe a DUI, and the problem drinker can quit. I blew right past that. I mean, because consequences were not in my vocabulary. They just weren't. I mean, I'm going, part of me growing up and part of me drinking was just, I got in trouble with the law. There was no, I didn't care. That was just part of the party. 18 years old also, my first DUI. And I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous at that time. And I remember it to this day. It was a tiny little meeting in Philomath. It was a Wednesday or Thursday night, and I walked in there. And, you know, court ordered, and the topic was serenity. And I'm like, I have no idea what they're talking about. And they're going around the circle. The one thing I do remember is this lady, she was old, you know, 40 50 years old, right? And she says, my idea of serenity is I just stay home on a Friday night and I pet my cat. And I'm like, this is just is not for me. All right? That was my first meeting. So I'm like, how do I get out of this? Somebody tells me right away it's an anonymous program, right? You just sign your own slips. I'm like, thank God. And so there I'm off ripping and running. And I get by 19, I have a wife. I have a son on the way. By 20, I'm divorced, and, one of my least proud moments standing up here, I just turned my back on my family. Selfishness, self-centeredness. I am a true example of self-will run riot. And I turn my back on my family, and I just go do what I want. And it's all about me. And I figure as long as I'm just doing what I want to do, I disconnect from my family and from my mom and my dad, and I'm only hurting myself. So, I'm still having a good time. So I'm a logger, exhausted on Friday nights. So, I get into something that, my friend Rick says, we call them, outside issues. He calls them drugs. I got into some stuff that kept me going a little bit through Friday into Sunday night, and that really, what it did for me is it accelerated my alcoholism. It just put the pedal to the metal for me. And that's when I really started getting into a lot of problems with the law. It was the alcoholism times 10. And I discuss this because, we can talk about a lot of stuff in here, but we don't like to talk about the non-conference approved stuff that we do. But we can talk about, DUIs and getting in crashes and killing people. But God forbid we talk about that, right? And I can say every bad decision I made was due to alcohol. My alcohol bookended both, both sides of, where I started, where the fun started, and where the fun ended, and everything in between was just chaos due to my alcoholism. And I'll give it just by the numbers of how it progressed quickly. I was a kid that never got suspended from high school. I got along with my teachers. I was kicked out of class. I liked to talk, That was about it. Never suspended from high school. I started racking up these charges, 22 years old. On my 22nd birthday, I turned 22 on house arrest. My 23rd birthday, I got some different charges. I'm in jail. On my 24th birthday, I'm in the second largest prison in Oregon, the Eastern Oregon Correctional Institution. That's the progression. That doesn't make me an alcoholic. What it does is that's what happens behind my alcoholism. I'm an extreme example, like I said, of self-will run riot. And to give you a little bit of history on how that progressed, I was ending a six-month jail sentence, 1995. It was followed by that jail sentence ended when I could get into a treatment program, and it was 28 to 56 days. And they were letting IV drug users out of there in 28 days. And I'm like, I go to the counselor, I'm like, well, when am I going to get out? These guys have real issues, it's like... And he said, Aaron, he goes, we're keeping you for the full 56 days. You're lucky we don't have a 56-week program. And I'm like, but what I didn't realize at that point was, there were so many underlying issues to my alcoholism. There was so much stuff that I had to deal with, and I had no idea. I just didn't. Just a couple months after that, I racked up some more charges, and that's when I was going to head to prison. So I didn't have, at that point, everybody I was hanging out with, I kind of separated myself from my town, from my family, all the families I grew up with, and I took on a whole new group of friends, right? Friends. And don't make me tell the story, Tim. So, whole new group of friends. And so I'm in the, my dad said one of the most heartbreaking things he saw as a parent was, when I had to come in shackled and chained to four other guys walking into the courtroom, and I knew I already had a suspended sentence going into prison. And my dad had asked beforehand, is there any way I can speak on his behalf? He asked my attorney that, and my attorney's like more than happy to have somebody speak on my behalf at that point. my PO was so done with me, she wouldn't even come across the street to sit in on my hearing. And so what my dad does is he gets up before the court and he says, "Your Honor," he goes, "I hope you give him the maximum prison sentence that you can under these guidelines, because he's a danger to himself and he's a danger to society." And that's what I'd become. You know, that's what I'd become. So from there, I go into Summit Boot Camp Program. That was a prison program we had there in Oregon at the time, and it was a great program. You cut time off your sentence. So I was sentenced to 24 months. This was a program of 6 months. It was ran by ex-military, Air Force, Marines, everything that you do in the military. I was prepared to do push-ups in the mud for 6 months. It was 16 hours a day, 7 days a week. We got one phone call, 10 minutes, you know, and like a lot of us hardcore criminals do, I'd call my mom every Saturday, you know, and she was always sitting by the phone, you know. But I made it through that. I was one of 23 or 24 out of 63 that made it through in my platoon. And they had work release in there. They had cognitive restructuring. They had alcohol and drug. They'd bring in meetings from Alcoholics Anonymous, which I thought was cool, but I'd never heard, you know. My friend always said it was kind of like Charlie Brown's teacher was womp, 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 you know. And so I set some goals from there. So you got to remember, at this time I was in Benton County. I was in town at Corvallis. It's a college town. There was about 60,000 people. I write my aunt a letter. I want to get out of town. I want to get away from the alcohol, from the, you know, alcohol and the other stuff. And so I write my aunt a letter. She lives up in Portland. So I hail them like, "Hey, I got to get away from the alcohol and the drugs. You know, can I move up to Portland?" And it's about, what, 600,000, 500,000 people. I'm like, "Yeah, smart move." And so this is the story. She said, "You can come up for about 3 months and stay with me." So I go up there. I enroll and I get a job right out of the gate. I enroll in college, 2-year program into criminal justice because I get out of prison and I want to be a cop. The big book, I believe, calls that delusional. I had a lot of delusional thinking. So I move up there, and it's not long before I thought, you know, I was weaned on the beers of, you know, I drank Jack Daniels and Hams and Olympia, and they had microbrews was a big thing. It still is in Portland. I'm like, well, this might be a little bit different. I'll try some, try a microbrew, you know, and, you know, right off the bat, guess what? It has alcohol in it. And, you know, the doctor's opinion has, you know, it talks about it. It releases the allergy. You know, I have an allergy that says once I ingest that, the allergy is an abnormal reaction, which means I automatically have a craving and I want more. Deal is, I live in a big town now. I kind of get away from the other stuff, get away from the criminal behavior, which now all I do is drink and drive chronically. But so I'm up there on this 3-month stand at my aunt's. 3.5 years later, I'm still working through the 2-year program. I don't have a job. I'm still living at her house. And she says, "Aaron," she said, "I think we've done all we can do for you here. You know, you're flunking out of school. You don't have a job. And so you need to get out." So I found a roommate. And I go out and I start applying for jobs. And I clean up a little bit. I'm going and, you know, I'm a highly logger. I have great work experience. I'm a hard worker. And but I have this criminal record following me around. I can't get a job. You know, what they told me in boot camp is just mark yes when they ask if you have a criminal background. Just mark yes on the application. And when you get in for the interview, you know, obviously these people don't have criminal backgrounds. When you get in for the interview, you just kind of explain yourself. I never got in for an interview. You know, I can't get a job stocking shelves at a grocery store. And I'm like, so I have a friend up there who moved up there, and he was a union guy. And he said, "Come on down. We have a distribution center." He said, "Just mark no on the application." He goes, "They have a very lenient background check, and I can probably get you in the door." And at that point, I'm like, it's worth a shot. So I get in the door. Yes, sure enough, lenient background check. They pass the deal. At that point, I'm kind of trying to clean up a little bit, pass the UA, get in the door. And it's around the time I was realizing, you know, maybe I have a little bit of a drinking problem. You know, I'll try to go, you know, a little while. These were the stints where I go through a little bit of sobriety. But I'm a Teamster. and I work right across the street from a bar. We work swing shift. I get off at 12:30 in the morning, and any union guys out there, you know, it's like they all go across the street to the bar. I'm going, you know, what the heck? I can probably go over and have a couple drinks. The difference is I start drinking over there. 90% of them can go home and, thank you, Lee. 90% of them can go home and come to work the next day. When I take that first drink, I'm missing Monday school, right? I'm missing Tuesday school. I'm missing work. And the party just begins when I start drinking over there. So I start missing a lot of work due to my alcohol. Getting suspended from work a lot. And it got to the point where, you know, we had a point system, very lenient. I don't know why you could call in sick 3 days at a time, which was great for an alcoholic. You know, I'd only get dinged for one thing on attendance. So, but I just kept getting suspended over and over. I'm living just paycheck to paycheck. You know, I got a gambling issue. You know, I'd get my paycheck and I'd shove every last dollar on booze on payday into the poker machine, and I'd have to borrow like 10 bucks from my buddy to go home and get gas to get back and forth to work, you know. And I'm living on ramen and toast, right? And we're making pretty good union money. And finally, I started getting sick and tired of being sick and tired. And that was about 2000, 2001. And this is the first time that I went up and asked for help. I've been through treatment, I think, 9 times on the last count. You know, treatment never kept me sober. But I went up to the general manager and I said, you know, I showed him my attendance. I have a serious drinking problem and I need help with this. I just need some help. And so they agreed. And so he agreed I needed some help. So they let me go through. It was an outpatient program, very intense. They made me go to me. This is another time I kind of sat in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it seemed to work for you guys. There was this big book, right? And I'm like, that stuff's not for me. You know, I'm going to do this self-knowledge. I'm going to do this on my own. And I did pretty good. You know, I started showing up for work. I started getting a few months of sobriety behind me. I work in a warehouse with 300 guys. There's about 7 women in there. And there was a young lady that came in there, and she was beautiful. Her name was Megan. And I'm not just saying this, you know, when you're in prison or working in a warehouse like that, you know, every woman that walks through is beautiful. I mean, if they look better than Tim, they're beautiful, right? And but this girl was legitimately a gorgeous, just natural beauty. I always say she had the pale skin and the long blonde hair, and she looked like an angel to me. Turns out her dad worked on the other end of the warehouse. He worked night shift. I didn't know who he was. He told everybody there, nobody dates my daughter. I didn't get the memo down on my end of the warehouse on swing shift. And she actually asked me out. Now, you got to remember, I'm sober at this time. You know, I'm not creating chaos. The thing I didn't, you know, her name was Megan. We go out a couple times and I realize, you know, I really like her and she really likes me. And I sat her down and I knew I had to be honest about one thing, and it was my drinking. And I said, here's the deal, Megan, you know, I'm sober right now. I have a serious drinking problem. And if we're going to continue this relationship, if I start drinking, you're just going to have to leave. You know, you're going to have to abandon ship. And stayed sober. Her dad wouldn't meet me for several months, even through my sobriety. And he was this big, burly, like, looked like a pit bull at the time. And it was just scary. It really was. And his buddies and him would walk into work as we're changing shifts, and they would just give me that look. And he would tell Megan, I'm not meeting this guy. I do not like him. So after several months, her mom finally told me, she's like, Martin, you know, she's in love. You know, if you want to have a relationship with your daughter, you're just going to end up having to meet this guy. So he had me over at the house for dinner. It was very quiet. I don't think he didn't say 2 words to me. We were going to go to a movie afterwards, and he wanted to have a little talk with me. He always says the first thing I did right is I actually showed up. And so he takes me in the other room. He sits there for, you know, a couple minutes, and he looks at me. He's like, Aaron, he's like, here's the 3 things I do not like about you. And it was all downhill from there. And he was still not happy that I was dating his daughter. So From there, I ended up going to visit a friend in South Dakota. I think I had probably 10 months sobriety at that time. I don't know how to have fun with an old friend without drinking a little booze, right? And I sat there, and I remember looking at that, and we were in a bar. And he's like, you don't have to do this, you know, and he was drinking. And I sat there, and I contemplated that drink for probably 20 or 30 minutes. But once that obsession starts kicking in, no matter how long it's been, I sit there and I think about it, and I think about it, and I think about it, and I'm going to drink. And next thing I know, I wake up in a blackout, you know, on his couch, and I have no idea how I got there. And if I went out and drank today after 15 years, that's the way it would be. You know, I'd be out drinking and driving tonight. Everything I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous would not keep me from drinking and doing the exact same thing. Because once I crack that beer and once I start drinking, once I take a shot of whiskey, all my common sense is out the window. I would say my IQ automatically drops by about 50%. So that's what happened. The difference is I come back and I told Megan the truth. And I said, you know, while I was gone, I drank. I remember her just breaking down in tears. And it was like she knew something that I didn't at that point. And the difference is she didn't pack her bags and she didn't leave. And but what does that do for an alcoholic? That tells me she's not going to leave. I can do this again. I can get away with this. She fell in love with me while I was sober. She saw something in me that I probably didn't see in myself. And for sure, her parents never saw in me, you know. And so she stuck it out. And God bless the Al-Anons in here. You know, like I said, if it wasn't for the Al-Anons, you know, just like Belinda said, for the Al-Anons and my mother's prayer, I wouldn't be up here tonight. You know, I just wouldn't. And she checked into Al-Anon and started doing that. She would, you know, she wanted to fix me. And she would buy me books on alternatives to abstinence, which was about controlled drinking. And I'd make it into the point I highlighted, oh, and now I can have two beers. And that was about as far into the book as I got. And I'm just an alcoholic through and through. You know, I start drinking, I just can't stop. You know, we agnostics, you know, I just can't stop. Once I start, I don't know when I'm going to stop. Maybe I can stop at a couple beers, but most of the time I can't. And so she sticks with me. I remember one time, she was the first one that, you know, my son was 10 or 11 at that time, and I had had very little contact. I used to show up for what I say were for photo ops, is basically what they were. You know, you'd see me at his birthday, you know, with something I bought him, or, you know, sometimes Christmas. And but there was times my dad promised me, your dad's going to come down here. And I remember my dad telling me, just heartbroken one time, he said, your son was over here, and he thought you were going to surprise him. And he kept looking around every corner, you know, waiting for me. I just didn't show. I don't tell anybody I'm not going to show up. I just can't show up, you know, and I'm out doing my thing. Megan stuck with me through all of that. And I remember one time she'd had enough. The way she met my son's mom was my son was up for the weekend. I decide my buddy rolls up outside and he's like, yeah, why don't you come out for a couple of drinks? We're living at this apartment. Sure enough, you know, I kind of sneak down the stairs. I don't come home for 2 days. And she has to take my son, call up my son's mom, and that's how she meets my son's mom. You know, father of the year, once again. And she stuck with me through that. And I would try to get sober, and I'd go through little stints of sobriety, and she would see the guy that she fell in love with. And, you know, here and there. I'd hide alcohol, you know, all over the place. I had alcohol hidden outside. I had a dog at that point. And I'd hide alcohol. I'd go over to the store, buy beer, and hide it outside. And every time I'd go out to walk the dog, I would drink. And I had the healthiest dog you'll ever see, right? Like, I'm just like, I'm walking that dog every 15 minutes. And she's like, wow, he really cares for that animal, right? So she sticks with me through all of that. Another DUI, I have the breathalyzer in my vehicle. And to give you a little, I would leave work and be, you could give me a lie detector test, and I'm sure you guys can relate to this. And the guys would go, we're heading across the street. You want to come over for some drinks? I'd say, no, I'm not drinking. You know, I'm not drinking. You give me a lie detector test at that point, I'd pass it. 30 seconds down the road, I'm pulling into the nearest convenience store, and I'm going in to get alcohol. And I have a breathalyzer. I have a 15-minute drive home. I know that doesn't go off for 20 or 25 minutes. I have it timed, so I can leave that vehicle running so I can go in and get the booze, so I can have that sense of ease and comfort within that 15-minute drive, you know. And if I get pulled over, you know, I have to explain to the cop why I'm driving with a breathalyzer with an open container, you know. That's alcoholism, you know. And it was just over and over, you know. I always say, like, the criminal behavior was gone. All I did was chronically drink and drive, and in blackouts. And I used to say I drove more drunk than I did sober, and that's the honest to God truth. I would try to get myself even just to go to work, and you know, I'd be driving down 205, which is a freeway where we live, and I'm chugging beers on the way there just to get myself even so I could show up, right? And Megan sticks with me through all of this, and her parents don't see what she sees in me. But I do, one thing I did right was during one of my periods of sobriety on a Christmas Eve, I hit a ring in her stocking, and I proposed to her, and she said yes. And I did that right, and I did it sober. So we're planning on getting, she drags me along. When I was, when she first met me, I'm living in, the last person that would have me in was my little brother, and I'm living in a back room. I'm 29 years old. I'm living in a, you know, a room he's renting me. And she's like, don't you think you want to move out and get an apartment or something? I'm like, I didn't even know that was possible for me to move out and get an apartment on myself. Usually I just bounced around from, hey, if a girlfriend had an apartment, I'm just moving in there, right? And so, yeah, so she was the one that kind of pulled me along, and she had a good job. She worked for a bank. She says she wanted to buy a house. So we go out to Malala, where I live now, and her whole family's out there. And we get a house built out there, and she's just dragging me along by my coattails. And we stayed with her twin sister, my brother-in-law, Joe, who was a Portland police officer at that time. And I'm trying to remain inactive. I would drive around the block just drinking, waiting for him to go to bed. You know how hard it is to remain in active alcoholism when your brother-in-law is a police officer and I'm driving home drunk every night. But we lived with them. We had a house built in 2006. We got married in September of 2006. And I was drunk, you know. I look back at the video, and, you know, I remember coming in, you know, where they're supposed to welcome the bride and the groom. And I, you know, I don't know what I'm supposed to do, and I head straight to the bar. There's no welcome. They got to tell me what I'm going to do. No, we got to introduce you, and I can't get to that alcohol fast enough. And that's what she had to live with. But she fell in love with me sober, and she stuck it out. You know, she stuck it out. But that was the last year of my drinking, was 2006. And as far as, you know, getting in trouble and all that, that was the worst year. You know, my son had this medication that I would take, and I'm like, I'm stealing it from him. And, you know, it was one of those medications where I can drink more, and I'm blacking out, and I'm having to tell his mom he lost his medication. Once again, father of the year, right? Father of the year. And I'm miserable. And half the time I can't make it up to go to work. 2006, I missed 30 plus days of work plus my vacation. I have doctor's notes for clinical depression, whatever it was to get me a note to keep me out of work, you know. And I was getting miserable. I was so sick and tired of being sick and tired. And the drinking, like I said, in the beginning it was about 90% fun, about 10% bad. And in the end it was about 10%, you know, I get that sense of ease and comfort. And I would just, you know, I'd stay up at night. I worked swing, and Megan would be asleep. She worked days, and I would stay up there, and I'd pop whatever pills I could. At that point, I weaned myself off everything else. You know, I'm taking prescriptions, not mine, but I don't feel so bad because there's a doctor's name on it, right? So I can stay up all night and drink and, you know, still crash out in the morning. And half the time, you know, she doesn't know what I'm doing. But, you know, I was a slave to alcohol. My brother always says, you know, I drank to be free. And by drinking, I created my own prison. And that's the truth. In the end, it was like, I'm in a bedroom and I'm begging my wife, you know, please, you know, just get up and get me some booze for tomorrow so I can make it to work. And sometimes I would and sometimes I wouldn't. And sometimes it was just enough booze to get me to get to the store, to the liquor store, whatever it was, to get some more alcohol in my system so I could function, you know. And I tried a little bit of Alcoholics Anonymous. There was one guy, my father-in-law, at this point, we just try, you know, he realizes his daughter wasn't leaving me. One time she packed up to go. And she went home, she packed a suitcase, and Martin's an old school guy, you know, and he's salt of the earth. And he said, she said, I'm coming home, I can't handle it anymore. And he goes, let me tell you something, Megan. And his favorite uncle, Martin's not an alcoholic, but his favorite uncle died of alcoholism. And he said, I'll tell you one thing, Megan. I can tell you Aaron's an alcoholic. And you can love him or you can leave him. But you're never going to change him until he's ready to change for himself. And so you can love him or leave him, but I'm not going to be that dad that brings you home every other weekend. So you make your choice. And so she made a choice to stay. That's before we got married and before I ever proposed. And she stuck it out, you know, through thick and thin. And she wasn't a drinker, you know, she was a normie. And so I just knew I was just miserable. And I would put together some, the big book says, one more attempt, one more failure, right? That was the story of my life at that time. And I remember sitting out in the driveway one time and had a little bit of sobriety and I'm just craving alcohol. I just thought about it and I'm like, is this the way my life is always going to be? That I get a little bit of sobriety and then I just drink into misery and I get a little bit of sobriety, or what's it going to take to get me sober? Is it going to be, am I going to be that guy that has to use a wheelchair to get him into a high school gymnasium to tell him the dangers of drinking and driving, and that's what got me sober? You know, these are the thoughts. I just could not stay sober no matter what. January 1st, 2007, I had probably 20 days of sobriety, and that's probably the longest stretch I'd had in a long time. And I'm running on self-will and self-knowledge. And I write down the very top of my New Year's resolutions. I write, do not drink, because I knew everything under that was dependent on that. And all I wrote was, be a better father under that, be a better son, be a better husband, be a better friend. Just wanted to be a better man. That all hinged on my drinking, right? And I'm going on my own self-will. You know, I can do this. My own willpower. January 5th, 2007, I take my son down to a little rock and roll show down in downtown Portland. Two blocks out of there, I get pulled over and I've been drinking. You know, I have that drink and I can't stop. I get pulled over with my 16-year-old son in the car. And I get a DUI, and they haul him off in a separate cop car, and he's crying his eyes out, and they take me down, and, you know, I'm down at the police station, and I say, hey, do you guys know my brother-in-law, Joe? You know, that's where I am, you know, yeah. And he's like, yeah, probably the proudest moment, you know, he's had as a Portland police officer. Hey, my brother-in-law, does anybody know him? You know, he's a big-time celebrity down here, right? And one of the cops came back, and they said, you know, your brother-in-law is out there. And he said, he doesn't want to have anything to do with you. He doesn't want to come down here. All he said, he goes, yeah, that's my brother-in-law down there. He's got a serious drinking problem and he needs help. And so one more time, Megan has to come down. She comes down with her dad. And I'm humiliated, right? Incomprehensible demoralization. And this time I've got my son in the car, the son that Megan helped me build somewhat of a relationship with. And I'm never going to drink again. I'm never going to drink again. Once again, I'm going to do this on my own, right? Oh, and I didn't believe in a higher power. This is willpower. This is the final lesson. This is the final lesson. 2 weeks later, I don't know how it is here, but in Oregon, they let you keep your license for 30 days. I don't know what that is, you know, after you get a DUI, hoping you'll get another one. I'm not sure why they do that. 2 weeks later, I'm driving home from work and autopilot. I'm sure a lot of you guys relate, and I'm pulling into it. You know, I had at that time about a 13, 14 mile drive home, and just automatically my car pulls like literally like autopilot, and I go in to get one 24 ounce can of beer. And this many years into my drink, I'm pushing 20 years of drinking, and it always starts out, I'm never gonna stop with that. But my head still tells me this time, it's going to be different. And the book says, you know, you ask an alcoholic 100 times why he takes that next drink, and 100 times he's going to give you a different answer. Once in a while, it might be the right one. I don't know any more than you do, you know, and I know you guys get that. And from there, that starts me on a 5-day bender. I'm drinking out of, shame and guilt, which is what I did a lot. You know, I drank out of shame and guilt until I did something until I drank that away, until I did something that I felt guiltier about. And then I would obsess on that, and I'd drink to get rid of that. And that's just how I ran. And so about 3 days into that, I'm drinking with my son. I'm feeding him beers. Last man I ever drank with my 16-year-old son. Yeah, I'm not proud of that. About 3 days in, I'm missing work again, and I'm right on the borderline of getting fired. Like I said, Martin works out where I did, and Megan's parents come over, and they're doing what normies do. You know, Aaron, you got to get up for work. You got to go to work. You're going to lose your job. You know, you got a house here. You got a house payment. You know, please, you know, you got to treat my daughter better. And they sat there for hours doing this, making me food, feeding me black coffee. And I would be sneaking off. I got to go to the bathroom. I got a bottle of whiskey back there, and I'm hitting the whiskey, you know, and I'm like, I can't get myself even enough to promise them that I'm going to make it to work. And I just, no, I can't do it. I can't do it. And I'm not going to go. And I remember to this day, I can still visualize, and her mom and dad leaving the house, and her dad just had his head down. And just like a dad defeated, he wanted to come over there and do the right thing by his daughter and kick me in the butt and get me out the door, and he couldn't. I just refused. I'm a slave to alcohol. And her mom turned around, and I was standing on the porch, and she just gave me that look of just disgust, of this is who my daughter chose to marry. What I did is I promised him, I'm going to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. When you guys leave here, that's one thing I'll do, and I'll give this a shot. I could not wait for them to leave so I could go down and get more booze and just get that sense of ease and comfort, right? And Megan, she ended up leaving with them. And like I said, I'm sitting in the living room. I got the shades drawn, and for the next 2 days, my son's missing school, and I'm giving him beer because I need somebody there with me, right? And a real bonding experience between me and my boy. But something clicks on that fifth day, and I'm in and out of blackouts, and I remember calling Megan on the phone, and I begged her to come home. Please just come home and talk to me. And so she did. And to this day, I don't know why she did, why she agreed to do that. And she came home, and I'm doing like a good alcoholic. We need to have a talk about my drinking. And I've got a case of beer there. And I'm, you know, you want to have a beer with me? Let's, you know, get to my level, right? Like, we're going to have a talk about how bad my drinking is. And she wouldn't. But she sat there and listened to me. And for the first time, I just crumpled. You know, I knew I had a problem, but for the first time, I just lost it. And I said, I need some serious help. I can't do this anymore. I just can't. And I sat down that night, and she went to sleep, and I sat there and I thought about it, and I scribbled out this note to her. I left it on the bathroom counter, and I said, you know, dear Megan, you know, I love you, and I'm sorry for letting you down. And I'm sorry for letting your family down. And if you stay home with me today, I'll go to a meeting, you know, some meetings with you. And she didn't see, she's a productive member of society. She gets up and she goes to work like normal people do, and she leaves me there. And I wake up just in time to figure out where a meeting is. And it was about 11 o'clock. And I find a noon meeting in Oregon City, which was about 10 or 11 miles away. And I decide I'm going to go. And I go and I look at this place sometimes. It's just this little shack called the Buena Vista House. They don't have meetings there anymore, and it's on the edge of a park. And I go and look at that, and it was January 24th, 2007. I walked up this old rickety building, and I walked in there, and my life changed. And thank God the chairperson, I believe in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, to the core, that this is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. All this is great. This is the fellowship. You know, the campouts are great. The barbecues are great. The rafting trips are great. But the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, that's where I found the solution. And what did they read in there that day? But what about the real alcoholic? Builds his life down, builds his life up and pulls it down. A real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Insanely drunk most of the time. Has alcohol hidden all over the house. Takes high-powered sedatives in order to get himself up and go to work. They were reading to me. And for the first time, I thought, but what about the real alcoholic? And I went over, and I remember this old lady, you know, and she grabbed my hand. She said, just keep coming back. And I'm shaking, you know, and I'm shaking. And I go buy two Big Books. I'm like, maybe I'd had several, you know, through the treatment center. You guys might know where this is going. I buy two Big Books because on the way home, I pass literally Megan's parents live on the side of the road. And I pull in there, and her dad's at work, and I pull in there, and I apologize to her mom, and I hand her a Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm like, you might want to read this, because this is where my problem lies, is in alcohol, right? And I don't know if she ever picked up that book, but it's still all about me at that point. So I get home, and what do? I'm like, nobody told me the page number. And I start reading from the beginning. And I find myself on every page, and I finally find that page. What about the real alcoholic? And I'm like, that's it. And I find myself, and I keep reading, and I just had this hope. And I remember telling my son, I remember I had 18 months sober, and I'm like, can you believe that I have 18 months sober? To this day, I can't believe I have 15 years, and I'm still in shock, and I'm still in awe. And he goes, Dad, I can't believe how different you looked the first day that you came back from Alcoholics Anonymous, because I heard hope in there for the first time. I came in there honest, open, and willing. All I wanted to do was quit drinking. And you guys gave me hope, right? And that light went on, and I had an obsession to drink. Always. My brother used to say, man, when you think about a drink, it's like a hamster on a squeaky wheel, and you can hear that. You obsess. Let's go to the bar. Let's do this. And that obsession would not stop until I drank. And I dug through that book and kept going in there. I'm like, I'm going back to that meeting. You know, there's something to this. About 3 days in, I heard this guy, Steve Little. I use his name now because he's passed, and he was this big, burly guy. And just a magnetism for Alcoholics Anonymous. He talked about getting in fights under the logging bridge. He was an old logger and stealing Mad Dog 2020 and the cops chasing him down with a gun. And said when he'd get pulled over, he'd grab the cop's gun hand first thing and punch him in the mouth. I'm like, I can relate to this guy, you know. Like, but people loved him, right? And I'm like, wow, you know, he has this magnetism. He's celebrating 20 years, and he was the first guy I went up and I shook his hand, and I'm like, congratulations. And I put myself out there. That was the difference. I didn't sit in the back of the room and look for the opportunity to leave. I looked for the similarities, and I just kept hearing them. And so I kept going back to that meeting. He gave me hope. I'm like, oh, here's the deal. I'm like, I like this. I'm going to find some other meeting. So I flip through this book, and it's the Can't Be Saturday breakfast meeting. And I go, my home group till today. And I go, God, these people can all afford breakfast. They must be doing better than I am. And that's literally how I picked that meeting. And so I walk in there, and same thing. I'm within my first 30 days, my first 7 days. I got a 24-hour coin in there. They're the nice brass ones, the heavy metal, and I'm like, wow, these guys really, and nothing against the plastic, I don't know if you guys do that back here, but I'm like, this is, you know, something, right? These guys believe in this stuff. And that room, it's a lot like this conference, you know, it's been talked about in there. It's never lost the electricity of Alcoholics Anonymous. And at that time, there was probably 40, 50 people that went to that meeting, and you'd walk in there, and just the buzz was electric. And you felt that energy, and it was like, this is so attractive. And I remember walking in, and I was early, and the first person I met was Steve Little, and he's sitting at the end of the, and Steve's deal was, he would remember your name, because early on, he said when he was bouncing back and forth, he'd been out for about 3 months, and this guy came back in, and this guy grabbed him, and he says, "Hey, Steve, how you doing?" And he goes, I left, and he goes, "I broke down in tears," and this old timer grabbed me, and he said, "What's wrong?" He said, "That guy remembered my name." He said, "How'd that make you feel?" He said, "It made me feel great, and he said, "Then you do it." And that was Steve's thing. He would remember everybody's name that came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And he made you feel important. He made you feel a part of. And so I listened to what was going on in that meeting specifically. And I'm sure a lot of you guys do it. They were talking about skydiving and traveling the world together and doing all this stuff and climbing mountains and going to concerts and sporting events. And I'm like, this is whole different thing than I thought Alcoholics Anonymous was. That was the first meeting gave me hope. The breakfast meeting gave me a view of a whole different life of what Alcoholics Anonymous was. It was a program of living, right? I literally thought AA was you went there 1 hour wherever you could fit a meeting into your schedule. You went there for an hour a day and you whined and cried about your problems. Y'all talked about how you wanted a drink, and then you just really didn't know each other outside of that. Y'all went home, and then you just met for an hour a day the next day, and y'all whined and cried. That's what I thought Alcoholics Anonymous was. And thank God for that meeting, And so on top of that, so I kept going back to the noon meeting. And one thing about that is I became accountable to that group. I wanted to do this different. And so what they would say is there anyone here in their first 24 hours of sobriety? And I would raise my hand every day, and I became accountable, and I said, "My name's Aaron, I'm an alcoholic." But they didn't say since the last, I thought they all thought I was drinking every night, because there was no disclaimer. I wanted to be like, "But I didn't drink last night." It's like all they said was, "There anybody here in their first 30 days of sobriety?" Every single day I would go in there. I could not wait for my 30th day so I could just say I've got 30 days, right? And I'm reading through this big book, and you guys give me so much hope in those first 30 days. And I hope if you're here and you have under 30 days, and Bree, I hope you're in here today, maybe not with the 24 hours last night. I just hope you guys get what I got. And I was just thinking, what a change in life. And I had that 24-hour coin. I just clutch onto that thing. It's 29 days. Like I said, I work a swing shift. And I work swing shift, and I remember we have a huge warehouse. It was a distribution center for Kroger, and I'm hanging on to that, and I'm hanging on to the 30-day coin. And I remember just finding a place. I find out later this is kind of like meditation. I just cling to that coin, right? And I'm thinking how much my life had changed. 29 days. You guys could give me. Let me back up. What had happened my third week? The hurdle for me was God. And if anybody in here, I'm sure there's a few of you, my hurdle was God. I didn't grow up in a religious household. I just didn't. I had no idea. But I was honest, open, and willing. It's indispensable is what the back of the big book says. I was honest, open, and willing. And I was willing to listen. I knew the God thing was going to be a hurdle for me. I just did. And 3 weeks in, Canby Saturday breakfast meeting, there was a guy by the name of Ron, and he was celebrating 20 years. And Ron had done 8 years in the Oregon State Penitentiary, and I used this story with his permission. And in the late 80s, he had killed a mother and her two children in a drunk driving crash. And somebody had brought a meeting in there. He didn't have a sobriety date because he says when he got his sobriety date was when he went to a meeting inside the penitentiary, and there was a guy named Chicago John that had grown up in Chicago, also had a manslaughter charge, and he pulled Ron aside after the meeting and he said, "Here's the deal, Ron. You can't unring the bell, but you never have to ring it again." And I listened to the feedback. Ron's a humble man, and I always still say, Bob Dylan said of Johnny Cash, after Johnny Cash passed, he said, Johnny was the North Star. You could guide your ship by him. And that's how I feel about Ron and Alcoholics Anonymous. He has such humility. But the feedback was how many people he had helped. He has a letter of forgiveness from the victim's family. And it switched. There was a switch that said, if there is a God up there, you read about this stuff in the paper, you see it on the news, how could he let something like this happen to a family? I listened to Ron said, you know, and he talked about that. Maybe these people died for my sobriety and it's my job to make their life have meaning. And blew open the concept, you know, kicked in the door, the willingness for a power greater than myself. And went home and I dug through that big book. This is 3 weeks in, and I find a simple prayer in there. And, you know, I hear Hot Sauce do it after the Serenity Prayer. I hear this, thy will, not mine, be done. And I start hitting my knees because I hear you guys talk about prayer is better when you humble yourself. And it was as simple as that, thy will, not mine, be done. And back to, I'm holding on to that 24-hour coin on my 29th day. I can't wait for the meeting the next morning. And I'm thinking about my life. And I've got it ironed out and how good my marriage can be. And how proud I can make my family. And what a better man I can be. So much hope. And I go home that night. And it's about 1:30 in the morning. And I walk through the bedroom door. And Megan wasn't breathing. And I rolled her over. She continued not to breathe, and I had to call 911. And they walked me through CPR on my wife. And they asked if there was anybody she could call, or I could call, or they wanted. And I said, please call her dad. And the deal with Megan is that she had had about 6 seizures in her life. And they were always in her sleep. And she took medication for them. The doctors always said, don't worry about it. You know, don't worry about it. Just let her have the seizures and you bring her in to check her medication levels. And it's not life-threatening. And I remember the paramedics showing up there and they went in the back room when they went in the bedroom with her. And I stepped out in the other room and they were doing their thing. Some people say, man, it felt like they were back there for hours. It didn't. It felt like they were back there for a couple minutes. And they came out and they said, sir, can we talk? Can we talk to you in the other room? And I knew then she was gone. That was the last person that believed in me, that I could do this thing that I knew personally, that believed in me, that met me when I was sober. Her dad pulled up, and he came into the house, and he thought it was just a routine, you know, a seizure. And I said, I tried to grab him. I said, Martin, she didn't make it. And he brushed past me, and paramedics grabbed him, and he just crumpled into his knees. And I heard the sound of a father's heartbreak. I never want to hear that again. And I knew right then my life was different. And I was at a crossroads. And I didn't make it to that meeting the next morning. And family was in shock. My brother came over and didn't get that 30-day coin. And I'm sleeping on the Saturday morning. That was late Thursday night, early into Friday morning. I found her, but it was about 2 a.m., 1:30, 2 a.m. And sleeping on the floor of the living room. And I got the door unlocked. I couldn't sleep in the bedroom. My brother was back there because it was too. I couldn't sleep back there for months. And the door opens, and Martin walks through it, and this is about 8 o'clock on Saturday morning. And he said, this is the last thing that I promised my daughter, was to get you to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous this morning, and you're going to get up and you're going to go. And what I didn't realize is she had called him the night before she passed away, and she said, Dad, I'm not going to be able to take Aaron to the meeting on Saturday. Can you get him there? I had no idea. And what I when I think of if I ever question a power greater than myself, I think what it took to get a father up out of bed within a day of his daughter passing, to take his son-in-law, who he doesn't like, to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I just can't fathom it. And he takes me in there, and I don't want to go. And he stands up, and he says, "Is there anybody here new that would like to share?" And he stood up. You know, we always ask if there's somebody new or from out of town. And he stood up, and he said, "I'm here to support my son-in-law. And my daughter passed away last night, and I'm fulfilling a promise to her." And I remember standing up and saying, "My wife, she wasn't a drug user. She wasn't a drinker. I should be where she is 1,000 times. 1,000 times before her." And there's a guy up there. "Is there anybody in their first 30 or that has 30 days of sobriety?" And today, that's one of my closest friends. His name's Gary. I know him from Adam at that point. And he gives me one of those nice coins. And he gives me a hug. He says, "Keep coming back." And that guy, Steve Little, stands up. He says, "This is Alcoholics Anonymous. When one of us hurts, we all hurt." And that room surrounded us for a good hour, hour and a half afterwards. And people gave us numbers and they talked to us. And there's a guy, Phil, who's still super active. And he talked about, he came up and he's like, "I lost a daughter named Megan. And I couldn't stop drinking afterwards." And he had about 5 years of sobriety at that point. And he hugged us in that room. You know, Martin to this day will say, "I've never felt empathy and compassion like I did in the room that morning of Alcoholics Anonymous." And they told me, "Keep coming back." And so I went back the next Saturday. On my year, I remember Ron saying, "If we were betting men, we would have bet you never made it back after that day." And so we have to put together a memorial within a week. And if you've ever been part of somebody that just, you know, Megan was 24 years old and just passes, right? And we put all this together and we put together a slideshow, and I'm a mess and I can't share. And the only thing that I could get out, and I turn around, and she was so loved. And some people say this, you know, they make people saints after they pass away. But I have never heard before or after ever anybody saying a bad thing about Megan. We're sitting in the front row and I turned around and that church was packed full of people. And the only thing I could get out is I got up there, and this is me. I'm a huge Johnny Cash fan. We were only married 5 months before, you know, and that's one thing. I'm glad she got the wedding because she really wanted that. And there's a beautiful version of Walk the Line by Johnny Cash. It's done by Travis Tritt. And if you're a fan of either one of them, Johnny Cash himself said one of the most, it was the most beautiful version he had ever heard. And that's what we danced to at the wedding. And my uncle was there, and I said, "This is my uncle's going to play it. You know, he's a local musician." And I said, "This is the first and the last song I ever danced with Megan. And it's Walk the Line. And it's a promise and it's a dedication." And to me, that was a promise that I didn't want to drink ever again. But I'm powerless, right? But you guys have helped me keep that promise one day at a time for the last 15 years. And I thank you from the bottom of my heart for that. You know, I can't ask for anything more. And my brother, he got up, and I'll read. We're both music fans, so you'll hear a lot about music here, you know. And I still to this day, besides the fact that Megan was 24, I'm still not sure why he read this, but he started off and he was able to get through a talk. And he says, he goes, "I'm going to start with a few words from Neil Young." And it says, "Old man, look at my life. 24 and there's so much more. Live alone in a paradise that makes me think of two. Love lost, such a cost. Give me things that don't get lost. Like a coin that won't get tossed. Rolling home to you. And I'm clinging on to that 30-day coin with all my life, with all my heart. And to me, that was Megan talking to her dad. Old man, look at my life. And I'll tell you what about that old man. He drove me to that Saturday meeting for the next 3 years. He took every Saturday. And he would go there and support me. And he told me at 8 years, you know, he's like, I need to make an amends to you, Aaron. He's like, I didn't like you. I was fulfilling a promise to my daughter, one meeting to get you to that first meeting. But guess what? He goes, I saw it was working for you. And I know how important it was to Megan that you stayed sober. So I kept taking you. And he would tell people, you know, I got a meeting to go to. And I think back and I'm like, he took every single Saturday and he's not it. We were going around picking up newcomers. He would do whatever he could to like, you know, I look back and that man is one of the, you talk about attraction rather than promotion. He is one of the biggest promoters to Alcoholics Anonymous there is. You know? Tim always says he had a front row seat to what Alcoholics Anonymous could do. You know, you took me from the scrap heap and built me into a man that that I can be proud of. I remember he would share. My mom, at about 2 years, she says, does he ever share at these meetings? And he did. He was salt of the earth, and he would share from the heart, and he would have people in tears. And I said, yeah, he does. He calls himself the honorary alcoholic. And people would chuckle. But when I said that day, I just broke down. You ever break down just from the heart and just cry? I'm like, he would be honored to be one of us. You know, he would be honored. And like I said, that man, one of my closest friends to this day, I said, I always tell him, Martin, you haven't been like a father to me. You have been a father to me. And he would say things like, you know, just the old, you know, if anybody else said it, it would be corny. And I remember him saying at AA meetings, you know, he'd say, you know, I might not have the nicest car and I might not have the nicest house, but I'm one of the richest men I know because I got a family that loves me. And that's how I feel about you guys in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm one of the richest men I know because I've got a family that loves me, you know. And from there, my life was, you know, we whine and complain about, you know, I had the DUI with my 16-year-old son in the car and I had to go through the court system and all that becomes so secondary. You know, the things that I thought were so impactful and, oh God, my life is ending. I lost my license for 3 years and I went through this DUI intensive supervision program. And there was lie detector tests. I mean, it was like, I remember the packet being like that thick of, you know, for everybody, it was designed for guys like me that just made excuses for their journey. You know, I couldn't have beer on a table in a restaurant with my family, lie detector tests. I couldn't hold a set of car keys. I had to sell my cars. I couldn't have a vehicle at the house. I mean, it was intensive. And I remember we had to sit through probation violations. It was part of it to see what we were getting into. And I had this. If I didn't have this, I had 24 hours in jail. And if I didn't have this, I would have been done 90 days. I would have lost my job. I would have lost my house, the whole nine yards. And sitting through these probation violations, and we're reading through this packet, me and a couple other guys, and the judge comes up afterwards. She goes, so, you guys learn anything here today? And guys, he's looking for the loophole, right? It says in there, he goes, oh, well, it says, you know, if I do everything right, I can graduate this thing early. And she goes, no, it doesn't. And he goes, yeah, it does, right here on page 56 or whatever. Just like, and she goes, oh, that never happens. But I'm like, okay, if they're going to keep their word and I'm going to keep my word and I got alcoholics behind me, I'm going to strive for that, right? I remember telling Martin, I'm still trying to, hey, is there a special thing? My wife passed away. Can I get a special license? And they're like, no. And I remember the judge saying, I'm sure your wife's family would be more than happy to help you out. And I'm like, how in the heck does it, you know, I don't think so. But they did. You know, every time I had to go to treatment, anything I needed to have, I had to get groceries, her sister, her twin sister would pitch in, and they're my family today. They're still my family. And there I was, 18 months into the program. I was 18 months in, and they let me graduate early. And one of my biggest prized possessions, this is a thank you to Alcoholics Anonymous is what it is. I got this letter in the mailbox, and I guess it was more than that. It was 2.5 years when I graduated. It was a 3-year program. And I went out to the mailbox, and I get this letter from the circuit court of the state of Oregon, and I'm like, these are never good. But I'm dotting my I's, and I'm crossing. I've never had a good letter from the... And I open it up, and like I said, this is a thank you to you guys. And it says, Dear Mr. Zyback, Mr. Weidenhofer forwarded me a copy of the email you sent of January 22nd, indicating you will mark 2 years of sobriety on January 24th, 2009. I did not want to miss this opportunity to participate in congratulating you on your success thus far. You made an impact on me when you started DISC. The loss of your wife was tragic, and you had many burdens to bear. As far as I can see, you have risen to this challenge beautifully. You have shown a commitment to your sobriety and the health of you and your family that I hope you feel serves you well. I believe it does. It is always easy to do well when life goes our way. The true test of character and commitment comes when life asks more of us than we expected. You have demonstrated an ability to stay centered in the midst of chaos and have moved through it to, I hope, a place of peace. May your higher power watch over you and your family as you continue through to a successful completion of DISP and a joyous free life. Best wishes, Kathleen M. Daly, Circuit Court Judge. And once again, I just crumple, you know. And the first person I shared that with was Megan's sister, because I didn't have it to share with Megan, you know. Lee's telling me I have a little time up here. I just want to touch on a little bit of what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. You know, I was able to stand on Mount Hood, 11,000 feet in the air, spread some ashes from Megan to the wing, you know, and I climbed up there, and I thank God and I thank Alcoholics Anonymous for where you've gotten me. I have caught my first steelhead. I have a great relationship with my son. I learned to snowboard. I've been there for the birth of my two grandchildren. You know, I have a better job. I lost the job I had because I lied on my application 10 years into this thing. But I want to wrap up here. The biggest gift I've got, I know this is Sunday, and I'm hoping I don't go a little over time. Here's the deal, is the biggest gift I've gotten recently, you know, I talked to Star. My mom was in poor health. She's had MS since I was a child. And she battled. She was at a care facility for a lot of years. But she became my best friend, my absolute best friend. The biggest gift I got in Alcoholics Anonymous was making my mom belly laugh. You know, I love that. And she got into poor health and recently. And, you know, the last 3 months, she was slowly going downhill. And I'd go over there every day. And, you know, I talked to her, and I still get reactions, and she'd smile every time I came in, and I knew she was listening. And here's where I'm going to go. I might never hear the words of Willie Nelson again in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, but this is the last thing that I read my mother. I bounced around in this book, and it's called Letters to America. And for whatever reason, this was on the last night. And because at this point she couldn't talk back to me, so I'd just read so she could hear the sound of my voice, you know. And I'd say "Mom," and she'd smile. It says God is a 4-letter word. It says no matter your religion, you likely have your own idea of what God is. Some think God is that big guy in the sky who makes all the decisions for us. Some say God is a woman, and some say God is dead. Some say God never was. My view is simple. I believe that God is love, period, end of story. For God loves through, God runs through everyone and everything. Every one of us loves the flowers, and the flowers love the rain. If you love the ocean, you know the ocean lives and loves to caress the shore. Love is the thing we all have in common. We ache for love. We hope for love. We love and like to be loved. That's God. Take these words of wisdom with you everywhere you go. Tell all the religions of the world, and through them the truth shall flow. But God is love, and love is God. That's all you need to know. Now, it's from a song he's just written recently. And it says, and then he goes on to a letter, it's, Dear God, the universe in which we're born is infinitely large. And he wants to thank you for letting me share.